supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Philadelphia City Council is investigating why getting a mortgage is still not as simple and free from discrimination as it should be. WHYY's Tom McDonald reports that although illegal since the late 1960s, new numbers show redlining continues even in this region today.
Redlining was banned in 1968, the practice where lenders drew a red line on a map around areas where they wouldn't give mortgages. Angela McIver of the Fair Housing Rights Center of southeastern Pennsylvania says modern redlining uses credit scores to limit loans, leading to discriminatory results.
Credit scores, income, and debt-to-income ratios, all of which is being used by banks and mortgage companies to redline Blacks, Latinos, and Asians, also indigenous people, out of opportunities to obtain loans to purchase and maintain properties.
Pennsylvania Attorney General Josh Shapiro says a recent published report sparked him to review the issue.
We need residents of the city of Philadelphia to help us with this. We want to hear from them. We have a special hotline set up where people can contact us with either examples of redlining or other things related that they're concerned about. Folks can call 1-800-441-2555.
Philadelphia Congressman Dwight Evans says about half the people in the city are renting, and redlining is preventing qualified people from receiving loans. He believes things are going to change, but slowly.
It's not going to happen overnight, so I want to tell anybody there's going to be a magic answer to it, but I believe that we are moving in the right direction.
Tiffany Green of Point Breeze says building more affordable housing can help reverse the trend.
If you really want to make this address this redlining for as the community, then make sure that the housing prices are conducive to the income. If you have people in your community only making $9, $10, $12 an hour, how are they going to provide or get a house that's running for $400,000 and $500,000?
Residents in gentrifying neighborhoods say redlining makes it harder for longtime residents to stay and easier to push them out. Tom McDonald, WHYY News.
The United States has historically imported a lot of international students, injecting billions of dollars into the economy and supporting local jobs. And in many cases, those students need to perfect their English before getting an undergrad or master's degree here. Though, as WHYY's Laura Benchoff reports, those programs and those English teaching jobs are on the decline in the Philadelphia region.
19-year-old Ali Ashkenani came to Philadelphia from Kuwait about 7 months ago. He wants to study industrial engineering in the United States, so Ashkenani enrolled in Temple University's intensive English language program. In the beginning, it was tough going.
For the first few weeks, I didn't understand nothing in the classes. I always keep focusing and I want to learn, I want to read, I want like that. And I improved myself.
Ashkenani wears glasses and a black fleece windbreaker, what seems like the de facto uniform in his advanced listening and speaking class, where he sits with 9 other students.
Let's take a look up here on the board.
At the front of the classroom, lecturer Anne Dramel begins to quiz the students from places like Saudi Arabia and New Caledonia on their vocabulary words.
We're going to play a game with these words, so now is your chance to ask questions.
Words like rigorous, ingenuity, and incrementally flash onto the smart board. Ashkenani asks for a refresher on the verb authenticate.
Authenticate. Okay, great question. Authenticate.
Many of these words come from a list of common language found in college-level courses, which students need to know to study in the United States. Dramel started at Temple in 2013 and says these days she's teaching these words to fewer and fewer students. Her first semester, there were more than 20 students in some classes. Now, her smallest class has fewer than 10.
It makes the classes interesting. I kind of prefer them to be smaller, but it's also a little bit alarming.
That story of intensive English classes shrinking by half repeats itself around the region and across the country. Open Doors, a group that tracks international student enrollment for the State Department, found programs like this one shrunk 26% last year, part of an overall flattening of international students in higher education in the United States. Cheryl Delk-Lagood is the executive director of English USA, a trade association for English language programs. She says there's a kaleidoscope of reasons why this is happening.
The dollar is so strong right now in the States, so the exchange rate actually for language programs, it just makes it much more expensive to come.
When the dollar is strong, currency from other countries doesn't go as far here, making these programs cost more for foreign students. English programs in other parts of the world are also becoming more competitive. Another big reason? Countries like Saudi Arabia and Brazil, which spend big on scholarships for their students to study abroad, have cut back in recent years.
There was kind of a bubble.
Jack Sullivan heads up the University of Pennsylvania's English language program. He says at their peak,
there was never enough spaces. Like, we fought for capacity for a couple years. How can we build, get more teachers, more classrooms, more teachers, more classrooms?
After that growth, the current slump is even more pronounced. And now there's a new fear among administrators that another problem could drive even more students away.
Then there's the Trump factor.
Reese Heitner is the interim director of Drexel University's English Language Center.
International students have a different perception of what it means to be an international student in the United States these days.
Altogether, these factors paint a bleak picture, especially for the Americans who teach international students. Heitner says Drexel's program has largely stopped hiring adjunct faculty, down from a peak of more than 20 guest lecturers a few years ago. But administrators say the changes are not all bad. Sullivan says schools are finding new ways to reach people who want to learn English.
One thing that has become popular are short programs.
That means focusing on programs that last a few weeks or that cater to people trying to enter a specific field. And remember that student, Ali Ashkenani? He says he's still jazzed to study in the U.S. Some of his biggest lessons so far have been language skills he didn't know he was missing taking English in Kuwait. Things like how to ask for a drink of water like a Philadelphian.
In our country, we said bottle of water.
Okay.
But at here, you should say parola fora.
While both are technically correct, he says he wants to speak English like an American and get a college degree in the United States because it will help him get a better job back home. Laura Benchoff, WHYY News.
Many kids in need of after-school activities head to their local library. But after a day in the classroom, a lot of them have energy to burn, and that's energy that doesn't always work in a traditional library. In response, the Free Library of Philadelphia is creating spaces that integrate active play with learning. WHYY's Shai Ben-Yaakov visited the first one to open.
It's a weekday afternoon just before 3 p.m., and Cecil B. Moore Library in North Philadelphia is quiet. But librarian Kayla Hoskinson says when school lets out, kids will flock to the library's newest attraction.
They really, really love it. Adults were kind of worried about it, a little skeptical. The first adults who came in when we reopened after having installed thought that like they couldn't see anything beyond the risk factor, but we actually haven't had any injury so far.
Sure enough, after sitting in school all day, the first kids in the library are literally climbing the walls. This past December, the library unveiled a 10-foot by 10-foot climbing wall. It's been a popular attraction, says Hoskinson.
So we have a group of in the community regular kids who come in every day after school, and they've told their friends, and so we've maybe doubled at this point of who we see after school.
It all started with an idea the library had to create play spaces where kids could get out some of that pent-up energy. Megan Talarowski is founder and director of Studio Ludo, a nonprofit that builds such play spaces. They partnered with the library. And the wall fits into a philosophy Talarowski adheres to in all of her projects. It's called risky play.
Risky play is the idea of encouraging kids to use their bodies in different ways that are developmentally appropriate for them. As we grow, we automatically want to do slightly riskier things with our bodies. We want to move more, we want to jump off of things, be higher. So if you look at the way that playgrounds have been designed, they're really geared more towards a younger age range. We say that we designed to the age of 12, but most kids kind of age out around the age of 8 or 9. So when we looked at the demographic of kids that are using this library, it's really in that 8 to 13 age range. So we're looking at what is getting kids in that age range active.
Play has changed over the years, and those of a certain age can remember going outside and not coming home until the streetlights came on. Play, Talarowski argues, used to mean few or no rules. Objects like bricks, rocks, or even pieces of wood became the grist for more imaginative play. Talarowski researched this kind of play in London, where newer playgrounds sometimes allow children to do stuff that would make helicopter parents cringe.
Full-on tool usage, like saws and hammers and nails, and they're actually building like large-scale structures.
It may sound like a recipe for disaster, but Talarowski says these play spaces are popular. Her research showed they attract about 55% more people, and twice as many adults use the spaces as well. Still, it'll be a while before they become widespread in the U.S.
Here, when we were talking about risky play, it's in a more confined setting, but they still get to move their bodies in ways that they've never done before.
Talarowski says being physically competent helps even in an academic setting.
When we talk about learning, not every kid is a book learner, and they may have that idea that they're not good at learning. And they come to the library because their parents send them here as something to do after school. But then they come in and they climb the wall and they get that confidence and they say, well, maybe I actually could be good at learning. So then they come back to their homework. Once they get their energy out in the wall, they gain that confidence and then they do better at their homework assignments.
More kids filed in. Some went straight to the climbing wall while others took out their tablets. The rise of such devices, Talarowski says, has eroded kids' physical competence.
There's a lot of data now about kids. There's like a rise in sensory disorders. Kids are falling out of their seats in class because they're not moving their body enough. They don't even know how to sit still anymore.
She says ultimately, encouraging more risky play could lead to safer choices down the road.
You know, if a child never learns how to move their body, if they don't understand that they can be up high and jump off the top of a climbing wall and be safe, then they may do something crazier, like go to a top of a cliff and leap off, you know, with their friends and think they'll be okay.
The library plans to open two more climbing walls at the Whitman and Wyoming branch libraries later this year. Shai Benyakov, WHYY News.
Las Vegas odds makers have great expectations for the Villanova Wildcats as they prepare to compete in the NCAA Men's Basketball Final Four. Do those expectations provide positive motivation or negative pressure? And for that, let's turn to Dr. Joel Fish, director for the Center of Sports Psychology in Philadelphia. Joel, thanks for joining us again on NewsWorks Tonight.
Great to be with you.
And let's note, it's not just the bookies. Wildcats fans have expectations, too, based in part on the team having gone all the way just 2 years ago and many of the same players and certainly the coach returning this time around. So how do we get at whether this is for the better or worse in terms of that motivation or pressure?
Well, I think Villanova is showing itself to be the exception rather than the rule. 75% of college and professional athletes say they would prefer to be the underdog rather than the favorite. And the reason for that is that the underdog has nothing to lose. But Villanova, through their program, has really figured out a way to embrace being the favorite. They welcome the pressure as being a challenge, as an opportunity. In sports psychology, we talk about the bigger the game, the narrower the focus. And I think the coaching staff of Villanova has been masterful in building a sense of trust among the players. Look, we're playing to win this game. We're playing to win and not to be tentative. And no matter what you do, win, lose, or draw, we are going to support you. You can trust us on that. And so the culture of the program has really lent itself to see these big games as an opportunity. And if you look at the consistency of how well they've performed, that's a testament to the success of the staff as well as the team.
Specifically, a testament to Coach Jay Wright?
I think the head here is always the one who leads the culture and builds the program. When you can have one great year, but to have consecutive years in recent past like Villanova has, that's building a program. And so from the top, through the assistants, through the team leaders, through the seniors, through the freshmen, there's a consistency. We're in this pressure situation. We know what to do. And whenever you're in a pressure situation and you can say, we wouldn't know what to do, I think you're going to be more in control. If you feel more in control, you're going to be more confident. And if you feel more confident, your natural talent's going to come out. That's the reason I think that Villanova has tended to play its best in pressure situations, whereas you see other teams in the tournament who have been upset because when the heat gets really turned up, their performance goes down.
So if I'm understanding correctly, does that imply that, for example, Loyola Chicago is a little loosey-goosey because they're playing with house money?
Well, I think it's easier to play when you have nothing to lose. And if you look at the anatomy of an upset in the NCAA tournament, all the upsets, and there have been a lot of them, including Illinois-Chicago, follow the same pattern. The underdog comes out and plays with reckless abandon. They've got nothing to lose. The crowd starts to flip, and the crowd loves the underdog, so they start cheering for the underdog. It's a close game in the last 5 minutes, and the favorite all of a sudden is feeling enormous pressure, and that pressure results in them making uncharacteristic mistakes.
Joel, the curtain comes up on the baseball season. Locally, the Sixers and Flyers continue their march to the playoffs, and yet everybody pays attention to college basketball for the tournament, and especially this weekend, whether they're a basketball fan or a college basketball fan or not. What's that all about?
Well, I think that the way the tournament is set up, it just lends itself to mass appeal, whether you're a basketball fan or not. It's the unpredictability of sport. There's such drama built into the fact that in sport you can't script what's going to happen. I think the brackets are set up so everybody can pick someone who they think is going to win. Whether you're a sports fan or not, the seedings make it clear to understand who's the favorite, who's the underdog. The schedule of the game lends itself to parties, and it becomes a social event. And because most people have a rooting interest in one team, you have an extra incentive also. So when you add that all up together, I think it's become not only a sporting event, but a social and cultural event that really it tops almost everything else, perhaps except the Super Bowl.
Dr. Fish, time for one more quick question. Yes or no, will Villanova emerge victorious Monday night?
I think the best predictor of future behavior is past behavior, and their track record is such that they tend to perform well in bigger games. So the fan, as well as the sports psychologist, as well as the lifelong citizen of Philadelphia, says, bring it on. I think it's going to be a good weekend for Villanova and for Philadelphia.
Joel, thanks again for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
My pleasure.
Dr. Joel Fish, director for the Center of Sports Psychology in Philadelphia. You may have seen productions of The Tempest over the years, the play about betrayal, forgiveness, and magic, set on a near deserted island, has been one of Shakespeare's most frequently staged in our region. Lantern Theater in Center City, Philadelphia is taking a crack at it now, and for WHYY, Howard Shapiro says this production is different from others.
You'll rarely, maybe never, see a production of Shakespeare's The Tempest as earthbound as Lantern Theater's. The play unfolds on an island where Prospero, the deposed Duke of Milan, has acquired the powers of magic. The Tempest is ripe for special effects that attract stage directors nowadays, but you won't see Prospero's invisible sprite Ariel, played by a bouncing shaft of light at Lantern Theater, or even old-fashioned stage mists swarming around the characters. You'll hear dim sounds and distant notes, and there's some shadow play in the light behind a scrim. But the Lantern's artistic director, Charles McMahon, stages this Tempest with his eyes fixed on Shakespeare's text, much of it beautiful English, nicely delivered by his cast. Ariel herself is portrayed by the busy local actress Bizanneau, who shows how a Tempest can work without the technical razzmatazz. She inhabits Ariel with exaggerated flickers of her eyes, a crouch, a jump, and curious animal-like twitches around her mouth. She's her own special effects machine, and she sold me on the Lantern's production, which has its peaks and dips, but balances out as a solid interpretation of a complex plot. The story begins with a huge storm Prospero and Ariel create to shipwreck all the people who had anything to do with usurping Prospero's dukedom in Milan. Prospero is commandingly played by the veteran Philadelphia actor Peter Delaurier. His daughter Miranda has grown up in isolation on this island without the distraction of boys. And it so happens that one of Prospero's enemies is washed up on shore along with his son. As in other Shakespeare plays, the young man and Prospero's daughter fall in love instantly. These two characters are a high point of the Lantern's Tempest because they're portrayed by Ruby Wolfe and Chris Anthony, whose performances create a rich longing from Shakespeare's words. The Tempest's major theme is about forgiveness in spite of a terrible wrong. This production makes it clear that families split by feuds can be made whole again, especially when the next generation has little reason to care about who said what or did whatever. The Tempest runs through April 29th. I'm Howard Shapiro for WHYY.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Find us on your favorite podcast app or listen back at whyy.org/news. Many Philadelphia area residents have a love-hate relationship with SEPTA. We need it, we use it, but we gripe about late trains and high fares. But not everyone. And on tomorrow's show, we'll meet a group of SEPTA groupies with a fanatical devotion to the transit agency. Yeah, believe it. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.